Hello, Jeha. Welcome to the Flourishing Practitioners podcast, where we talk all things about space holding, caring for our clients, and succeeding in our businesses. We explore the wisdom from coaches, counselors, and healers. My name's Gabrielle Walker, and I'm so honored that you're here. Let's dive in. Our episode this week is with Erin Mumford, and she is the general manager at Ararat Wellness. And this was a really beautiful discussion on our Neurodivergent series. Erin has a passion for safe foods and finding out what helps people eat healthily in different ways that allows sensory needs to be met, but also health needs. And it's an ongoing exploration. This is a topic that's very alive for her and actually many of my clients at the moment too, looking at food, nutrition, and the various things that we've been told along the way. I hope you enjoy this one. Hi everyone, today we are here with Erin Mumford, and she's the general manager at Ararat Wellness, and she was diagnosed with autism at 31, ADHD at 33, and works in the space as well, but has been working with people throughout her adult life. I'm really excited to talk today and see where our conversation goes. Welcome, Erin.
Thanks for having me.
So the question I usually start with is there anything on your heart at all?
Coming into the end of the year, it's been a really tough year for people. We're all kind of hoping that next year will be this light that shines through the darkness and that'll all be different. I kind of am secretly hoping that too. I'm not really sure where we're going to sit with next year, but I think I've really learned and grown in the last 9 months of my role, and something that I really want to see in my work is really pushing the boundaries with how much we can support and help people in the neurodivergent community, first of all, stay at work, get back to work, or actually be supported in their workplace. And that's something that I really want to bring to the table next year even more. So hopefully 2026 is a little bit shinier than this year.
Would you explain your organisation and role at the moment?
So Ararat Wellness, we provide primarily behaviour support, so we're a registered NDIS provider. We also do counselling. Basically, my role originally was to come in and kind of help out Karen, because there is actually so much to do. I don't think people understand the sheer load of administration work that goes on behind the scenes, between audit preparation to the paperwork to, and, you know, we're getting numerous amounts of paperwork that needs to be completed every day because the NDIS continually upgrade risks and all of that kind of stuff. You've got to be able to monitor those. So my role primarily was to come in and support with the registration audit for the midterm audit back in July, I believe it was. Kind of feel like all the months have melded together. I feel like I've been at Ararat Wellness for a lot longer than I have, which is not a bad thing. It's fantastic. I actually never want to leave. And so now my role is still a lot of that audit prep, but keeping our audit ready status and making sure that we are continuing to maintain that. But my goal is not to just be audit ready. My goal is to be best practice. I want to have best practice across every single area of our company so that we're making sure that all our participants' rights are upheld, that their choice and control is upheld. They can make decisions and be supported by us. And then on the other side of the coin is we're making sure and have documentation that we have upheld choice and control, that we've upheld their rights. We want to be able to support them to reach their goals. It is a very boring side of the job, but I also get to do things like supporting the group facilitator to come up with new ideas and working on how can we make this intake process easier for clients and better for clients, and do we need to come up with a better system. I also now get to do behavior support because I'm a registered practitioner. That kind of adds a little bit of diversity too. I've worked with clients for over 10 years, and I think probably over the last 8 months, I had a bit of a break from that, which was great. I missed kind of being in the part where you can see the growth and people building their strengths and things like that. So I'm really happy that I'm doing a little bit of that on the side. Primarily, it's all the day-to-day running of things, making sure, unfortunately, sometimes it is about making sure boxes are ticked, but if we can do that in a way that supports our clients better, that's what I'm aiming for. So that best practice side of things. So that's pretty much my job. I do everything except for the invoicing, because I don't want to ever do invoicing because that's been too much.
Did you do a double degree in human services and social work as well?
I tried to do the social work. So I actually ended up just leaving with my bachelor, and then I dropped out because, yeah, I couldn't do full-time work and full-time placement and survive at the same time. But I was really glad that I didn't end up doing social work, actually, because I don't think social work's for me. But then I ended up doing case management and stuff anyway. And now I've done my grad cert in BSP. So
cool.
Awesome. Yeah, it's exciting. Finding a direction, right, 10 years after you study. It's like, finally, yes, I know what I want to do now.
Beautiful. Thank you. You have autism and ADHD, but how do you define that for yourself?
I think once I got diagnosed, it was like my whole world just changed. When I was younger, it was almost very much like, Erin's the problem child and there's always something wrong with Erin. And what are we going to do with Erin this time? It was always a diagnosis where it was like mental health or PTSD, or I think they even diagnosed me with OCD at one point, to which I was like, how did you get there? Cool, but I'm the messiest person alive and I don't do things on repeat generally. But when I got diagnosed with autism, it was kind of like this light that kind of was like, hey, it's okay to not be okay, basically. At first, I had no idea what it was about when I first got diagnosed. I was like, do I even like the music that I think I like? Or am I pretending to like that music so that everybody else thinks I'm super cool and super like eclectic and whatever? Like, am I building this personality? So for me, it's been a real eye-opener to go, actually, I don't like that music and I don't like those events and I don't like those people. And I don't like those television shows. And yes, I will watch the same TV shows on repeat. And that's not because I'm stuck as a 17-year-old girl. It's because I'm seeking routine and structure and just being able to learn more about how my brain works. And that, for me, has been one of the most incredible experiences. I feel like I'm almost being born again into a world where I feel like I can actually redefine myself for me, not for anyone else, not for my partner or my parents, just for me. I have had people say to me that after I got diagnosed, I made it my whole personality. And yes, I did, because I don't care what other people think anymore. I think when you do make it your whole personality, you actually can be who you are. There's no masking. There's no more trying to fit in. There's no more changing yourself to be somebody else. It's just you being you. And sometimes if you need to thank the autism, which I do on a regular, or I say, can you just go away today, please? I just wish I was normal. I'm allowed to talk about it because that's who I am. And that doesn't mean I'm making it every aspect of my life.
I love it. There's so many little nuggets in there. I really want to dive in. I don't know if you know, but I was diagnosed a few years ago as well with ADHD, even though he said I should go through the autism test, I decided not to, but I'm unmedicated. But I am very interested in the unmasking process because I've had a very similar experience to what you described, where I sort of became obsessed with it for a while because I was like, who am I even? And why have I done this thing? Even just little things I notice at this time of year where people are like, what are you doing for holidays? It feels like an irrelevant question to me. You know, I'm like, what do you really mean? What do you really want to know?
Yeah, I could actually tell when I'm doing it now. You know, I was at an event not long ago and my husband turned to me. He's like, hey, can you do that thing that you do? And I was like, what are you talking about? He's like, you know, that thing where you're really extroverted and can talk to people. And I was like, what? Like, okay, cool. Don't know how I get to that point, but sure. So I just kind of walked up to people and it was almost like a shudder that came down over me. I could almost see it. And it was like, I was a whole different person. And it's quite scary, I think, when people see that, because the people that know me unmasked know immediately what I'm masking. But the people that only know me as masked, they think I'm weird when I'm not masking. So I have very different connections with many different people, and with masking as well, it's that real protection. I'm not going to show anybody my true personality or my true self, because what are they going to do with that? Are they going to take advantage of me, or are they going to think I'm just weird, or am I not going to be able to fit in with the crowd? And then I'm going to have extra anxieties, because then I'm going to go home and wonder, oh my God, did they hate me? Did they not like me? The real me. It's like a never-ending story, really, of just constant anxiety and trying to fit in. When I'm in those social settings, it's like the energy required to actually be somebody else while also trying to be me. It's exhausting. And so I come home after an event or a day of work and I just fall to pieces. And then, you know, I wonder why I can only eat 2-minute noodles because, or I can only eat food with no flavor. The amount of chips and gravy that I eat is astonishing. And it's also delicious. So I don't know why anyone would not want to do it. But masking is just amazing when you figure out what parts of you are masking. And even when you're alone, how can I make myself be better? I'd practice speeches in front of the mirror all the time when I was younger. And I always thought maybe it was just me being dramatic or me wanting to be an actress one day or something like that. But what I was really was me going, okay, how do I have this conversation with someone else? And then I'd act out every different possible way they could react. It takes up a huge amount of time and it's hard. But I'm actually discovering that I'm a really cool person underneath the mask. Like, I love reading. I love weird music that has weird sensory sounds. I love painting. I love art. I like to plan things sometimes, and sometimes I'm okay with just going with the flow. There are some not great things about the diagnosis and being unmasked, but the people that I think are around me and love me and I should want to have around me, they would never judge me for that, which is great. And it's also helped me figure out who I don't want in my life as well, who doesn't like the person that's under the mask. They can go away. So yeah, that's been a really big thing this year, actually, is kind of moving forward from relationships that aren't supporting the person under the mask.
That's beautiful. Yeah. For those who don't know what it is, they might be listening and they don't know about ADHD and autism. I guess first, what is the distinguisher, how you see it between the two?
Between ADHD and autism?
Mm-hmm.
I love watching any kind of videos on Instagram and stuff where they have somebody will be in the car and they'll be singing and jiving and being really loud and just making weird noises, and the autistic person sitting on the other side going, oh my God, would you just shut up? And that is like the constant fight in my brain. Like constantly, I want to be spontaneous, but I also want structure and planning. And then when I am spontaneous, it feels really good. But then later on, because I had to mask while being spontaneous, I'm exhausted and I just want everyone to leave me alone and don't touch me, turn off the lights and feed me 2-minute noodles or chips and gravy. Then the next day I find this hyperfocus and it's like constant chaos all the time and it's never controlled. But I used to just get overwhelmed by it. And then someone said to me, just lean into it. Just go with it. Lean into what you need. Don't worry about anybody else. Just lean into it. And that's helped a huge amount because now my husband knows when I've had a really big day, just leave her alone. Like, even if she seemed really happy and in the moment and spontaneous, there will become a time in that day where I just need to close myself off. So that's pretty much how I see it. It's just a gigantic big whirlwind of chaos most of the time. And it's kind of fun in a way, especially when I'm unmedicated. I don't take my medication every day. There'll be times like for holidays and stuff, or if I'm going shopping with my friends, if I'm going to parties and things like that, I'll be like, I'm going to go unmedicated today because I just want to be myself. They're the really fun. They're the fun days that I get to have, but they are chaos as well.
For those who don't know what masking or unmasking is, they might begin. How would you describe that? What's the distinguishing factor?
It's kind of hard, I guess, to describe it because I think it's different for everybody. But I suppose if you can sit with yourself unmasked and figure out who that person is. So unmasked, I am generally quite, it's hard because I have ADHD and autism, right? So on one half of the unmask, I am ridiculously silly. I will run down the corridor singing music and whistling and just having fun. And then on the other side of the unmask, autism side, I'm kind of like this quiet person who just wants to sit back, eat cheese shapes with my vanilla Coke and sit in bed and read. But then the masked person is very confident, very charismatic. I can talk to pretty much anybody. I can go into a social situation and have these really long conversations that seem very normal, where I just almost, and I've practiced it so well over the years that people don't know that it's a mask. They just think it's who I am. And then they go and they meet the real me and they're like, that's weird. Now that I've done it so many times, I kind of know exactly when I put that mask on now. Whereas before, it took me time to sit with it and identify it. If you're trying to figure out what your mask is or where your mask stops or where it begins, I think it comes down to reflecting on what your values are first. One of the greatest things I ever did with one of my therapists was go through what my true values were, just as me, no judgment in that space. Like, okay, cool. Everybody likes love or respect, but is that really on my values list? Like, what are we talking about? Are we talking about respecting people in a general space, or are we talking about respecting myself? And there's so many different ways that you can take those values. Is that value really part of my set of lists, or is that part of the world's list? Is that what they want me to be valuing? Do they want me to value money? Do they want me to value love? Do they want me to value compassion? Because sometimes I'm quite a compassionate person, but when I'm done and my energy is zapped, compassion is not one of my values. Respect for myself is then one of my values. And sometimes I need to stop being compassionate because it is constant burning of energy, you know? It's very hard to explain.
I get it completely. There's this lady called Susie Welch. She does a lot of values testing, which I found really interesting. I'm still pondering a lot of her teachings, but one of the things she says is that things like love and compassion, they're actually virtues, not values. So we all actually have those things that we believe in. They're ideals that we all want to live to. Other things are actually values. So where do we prioritize money? Where do we prioritize work? Where do we prioritize family? They're values. So we all think they're important. But love, those sort of things are actually virtues.
Interesting. I really love to read that. I think it's depending on the situation too, like where are you in your life? Have you got kids? Are you on your own? Have you got a partner? Are you working part-time, full-time? So many things can change. And then you throw in a couple of neurodivergent spicy brain cells and that shifts all again. And you've got to kind of go, oh, hang on. Do I actually care about that? Or do I only care about that because I think I'm expected to care about that.
I found for myself when I pondered it as well as part of my unmasking journey, like I think I almost over-enacted compassion or having to show up because I don't have the marker of when enough is enough. But I'll bypass, because my enough is actually quite small compared to what I perceived other people's enoughs to be. I'm not in their world, so I don't know what their enough is. but mine was actually quite small. So when I was being, more was always being asked of me, again, these air quotes.
Yeah.
I don't know if it was or wasn't, or if that was just what I was picking up from the vibe, that I was always bypassing it. So I had no idea how to actually read my signals of when something was finished or the timing.
This is probably one of the most embarrassing things for me. Is I don't even get signals of when I need to go to the toilet. So I don't get signals in anything. It's taken me a very long time to understand social cues. And even then, sometimes I still don't get them. Like, when do you stop? Do you stop when you're dead? Because that's what the world teaches you. You sleep when you're dead, right? But it's really about relearning how your brain works. And I think that's been the biggest part of having the diagnosis and not just going, oh, great, I've got this diagnosis. Now I can use it as an excuse to explain all of my behavior or all of the ways that I don't want to be this person or whatever. I don't think that we should be using it as a way to scapegoat bad decisions or bad ways to treat people. You can still be autistic and treat people with respect and treat yourself with respect, but it's learning how to do that again. It's almost like we've gone to school, we've been taught how to live life and what to do and how to be treated and everything like that. It's almost like we need to go back again. But unfortunately, when you're diagnosed at 30, there's not really a school to go to. So you kind of have to do that yourself. And that's also part of the research of reading and talking to other neurodivergent people and having those people around you that understand or maybe have gone through that before you to say, this is actually really normal for you to feel this way and it's totally okay and this is how we do this. And Karen from Arrow Wellness, she's been a huge part of that journey for me, as well as all the other women that are there, because they just get it. They've been through that diagnosis journey before. They've kind of realized where they're at with theirs. And they encourage you to go, but why don't we look at that situation from an autistic lens? It's not really okay that you had to do that, or that's very normal, or you're reacting to this situation because you maybe don't have the same level of tolerance as others in terms of the energy you're putting into something. It's the constant work it takes to reframe your life to be who you really are, when what I've been taught was taught for 30 years of how to be a neurotypical person. And now I have to unlearn 30 years worth of stuff. Yeah. It's difficult, but it's kind of fun at the same time. Cause I'm like, cool. I get to have a big beanbag and sleep in it. And, you know, like I have this gigantic beanbag. It's just there. Do you want to look at it?
Yeah.
It's huge. Yeah.
Oh my God. And like now I feel totally guilt-free. Just laying in my beanbag, doing nothing, because I know that for me, that's what I need. Whereas before, I'd be like, oh my God, I've got so much to do. I can't just sit around all day doing nothing. That's lazy. No, it's not, actually. It's just self-regulating. So, you know, I like it. It's fun.
I like that. Thank you. I'm going to ask you a question that a client actually asked me a few weeks ago. She's on her unmasking journey and she was a little bit like, does it feel like you just jump off a cliff and you're falling? Or because there's that feeling I remember having it a little bit where I was like, if I decide to unmask, it's this terrifying thing. But yeah. I've actually experienced it to be more of an unfolding and realization slowly like, oh, that's not authentic, or, oh, why am I doing that? And then little periods of terror.
Yes, absolutely. I think the unfolding of the paper is a really great way to visualize that. I kind of imagine it as one of those little origami stars. I'm like, which one am I opening today? And I'm just going to pick a color and then let's see which one we're going to open. And then you get kind of like that little bit of paper that comes up and goes, today you will do this. And it's like, today you'll unmask this, or today this is what you're doing. Sometimes I go, oh yeah, that makes sense. Like, or I'll see a video on TikTok, or I'll have a conversation with someone, or I'll just be sitting here and going, why am I actually doing, I don't really enjoy this. I'm going to leave now. So it is definitely like the unfolding of paper. It's definitely not like jumping off a cliff. I think at first when I had the diagnosis, I wasn't supported. I was on my own. My husband was actually overseas at the time. And so I spiraled really quite quickly because all of these things from the assessment started coming in and being like, oh my God, like, for example, in the assessment, they do like a thing where they get you to show them how you would brush your teeth. And I was like, I can't even brush my teeth right. I can't do this right. And so I think when you get that diagnosis, it's really important to have that support around you to kind of help you self-regulate and calm down. But then once you get to that point, it is just like the unfolding of that little origami. And sometimes there can be tiny little moments of terror, but it's almost like in a dream where you think you're falling out of bed, but you're not. That's kind of the little bit of what you get, you know.
Like that. I also found it challenging initially to know how to describe myself to others with all the discussions around labels and things like that, because I don't lead with that normally. But when I was sharing this new diagnosis, then people would be like, oh, I want to tell you about my experience or something like that. And then it was like very confusing for me to navigate where it sat for myself. Did you find something around that?
It kind of felt like when I started sharing it, because the same thing, it's like, oh, I've got a new label now. I can share that. Maybe people will understand me a little bit better if I share this particular label with them. They'll get a full understanding of my personality. No, they don't. They got no idea usually. And what they'll come back at you is, oh, everyone's a little autistic. It's okay, you'll be fine. And it's like, what do I do with that? I don't even know how to respond to that. I used to just kind of go, oh yeah, cool. I guess everyone is a little autistic. You've just invalidated my whole experience, but that's cool. And I'll just take that on board and accept it because I don't want to deal with confrontation right now. And I also just have no idea who I am or what it is that makes me more autistic than everybody else, you know, air quotes. And I still do it. I still say to people, hey, just letting you know, I've got autism. I do catch myself still doing that, because then it almost gives me permission in their space to be myself. But I really shouldn't have to do that. But it's kind of like, if I don't do that, they're going to think I'm weird and maybe they won't have the same respect for me. Some people will go, oh, okay, well, that makes sense. I'll be a little more gentler with you. So why does it take them to know that I'm autistic for them to be gentle with me? Why can't they just be that way anyway? It's definitely a really hard thing when you don't know how to label yourself even before that. And then all of a sudden, yes, I've got a label. I can finally put it down to something, but then the world has no idea what you're really talking about. And I wish people did know more. I wish there's so many different types of people out there that have got autism. You've got people that have got level one. I don't even think people realize that there's multiple levels of autism, like there's level one, two, and three. There's people that are nonverbal. There's people that shut down and just go within themselves. There's people that melt down externally. And then you've got the whole nature nurture thing, which also impacts the way that people's brains work when it comes to that. Like, for example, like, did you grow up in an abusive home, and all the other parts of life that impact someone with autism that shapes it to be so unique. And so I don't know if it's really ever going to be something that the world will be able to understand completely, but there needs to be some kind of understanding that maybe people are just different irregardless. And let's be gentle to everybody. Why do we have to be hard on everybody?
That's my view, because I think even with the different stimuli and things like that, light and just giving options to people, not like, here's this cookie cutter thing that we all have to learn how to live with. I'm not saying everyone's like got an autistic range, but everyone's got a range of stimuli in terms of what light they want, what sort of spice they want in their food, all the things. So why can't we allow that?
For my whole life, I've been called a picky, fussy eater, right? It really started to bother me probably in my early 20s. And then when I found out that I was autistic, I was like, oh, I'm not fussy. I just don't like that texture. Like, I'll eat frozen yogurt, but I won't eat regular yogurt. I hate regular yogurt. It's so gross. Like, it's like slime. But frozen yogurt, I'm there. I am so there and ready to eat frozen yogurt. It's not even funny. So it's like, I'll still eat yogurt. It just needs to be presented in a different way. And so I think people look at the world and I go, okay, cool. I will do that, but maybe present it in a different way. My office at work, I don't go into my office when the big lights are on. Like, I'll actually avoid it. But the minutes those low lights are on, I'll actually use it because it's presented in a different way. So it's not that people with autism are fussy. It's that we just maybe have a different way that we like it to be presented to us. I think it makes sense. I don't know about other people. Makes sense.
It makes sense to me too. So I wonder, how does it feel to work in the space that you do with autism and ADHD?
It's intense. I used to think that I'd had to put in so much more effort to be good at what I did. And I think that's why I was so good at what I did, was because I put in such a huge amount of effort to make up for the parts of myself that I thought were deficit. So in this industry, I'm always able to be myself, even without the diagnosis. The best part about getting the diagnosis was actually being able to support others in that space and being able to understand when I work with clients or when I work with staff. And to be quite honest with you, the difference between staff and clients is nothing. They're humans. We're all human beings. And we all have exactly the same way that we need things done at our own pace, at our own time. We need things explained to us in our own unique ways. So there's really nothing different between a participant and a staff. That's what really helped me understand. My husband says it all the time to me. He goes, stop counseling me. And I'm like, I'm not. You're just a human being. I'm just being kind, because that's exactly who I am at work. I'm just a kind person that will have a general conversation with somebody. I don't really put them in a box of, you're a client. Obviously, there's boundaries and things are a little bit different. But when it comes to working with that person, I don't treat them any different than I would a staff member. Everyone's on the same level. And when we have issues at work, we talk it through, we're through the same thing. But that was a really big eye-opening thing for me. It wasn't, there's a hierarchy or anything like that. I don't want to treat anybody different. I don't want to treat staff, because this is my first management role. And unfortunately, I'd been micromanaged in the past, and there'd been almost a hierarchy where I was like, I'm actually afraid to go to my manager because I don't know if I'm going to be just told I don't know what I'm doing. I have no idea if what I'm actually saying at the moment is in line with anything, because my brain's just word vomiting this whole thing. That's the ADHD part of my brain. But I was always afraid to step out of line. I say to my staff now, I'm going to give you permission to put in boundaries. If you need to put in boundaries with people, do it. I'm not going to get mad at you for saying no to somebody and then them getting mad at you and making a complaint. That's not how the world works. If you're following our policies and procedures and you're doing your job and putting in those boundaries, I'm going to stand by you because that's what people need to hear. In the neurodivergent world, we need to hear that stuff. We need to hear, I'm going to back you up. I'm going to be here. We can't assume that. We don't assume that. We assume that we're alone all the time. And so it's the same with clients. I'm going to do this with you. I'm going to be here for you. I'm going to back you up because this is what I've said that we need to do. This is the process. And I think, you know, even neurotypical people, right, I think they would love to hear that. They don't hear that enough. They don't hear that they're supported and they're backed up and that somebody's on their side enough. And I think that the neurodivergent way of managing people is so much better than any type of management that I've experienced ever in a neurotypical world. In one of my jobs, I was brought into a performance meeting in the first 6 months four times. Within that meeting, the first meeting, I was told that I wasn't friendly enough because I wasn't saying good morning to everyone in the building. The second time I was brought in, it was something to do with communication. The third time I was brought in, it was, you're doing better, but you don't seem genuine. And then the fourth time I came into that space, there was, you're doing really, really great. The thing was, I changed nothing. So I was so confused. I was so confused at that point of, can I just not do anything right? Or I don't know what you want from me. You want me to say good morning to people, but I thought I was. It was a really confusing time and I have no idea what the initial question was. So that's really, because that's how my brain works.
For babes.
Yeah.
I really relate to that. I find some of that, you know, like when I get into work, I want to do my job in that moment. That's what's on my head. So all the good morning stuff just feels really annoying. I care about you people, but I'm not going to walk around the office and say good morning. Like I've got this head that needs to become onto whatever.
Yeah. And like my first thought some days is, Erin, you really need to eat something because you haven't eaten breakfast yet. So I need to get to the desk, turn on the computer while the computer's turning on and go out, make my breakfast, get back into the room. Then I've got to go through my emails. And I think about all that before I think about saying hello because I'm like, oh, well, everybody knows me here. They know that I'm not mad at them if I don't say hello. I'm just doing what I need to do to start the day. And then sometimes at like 9:30, I'll come and be like, morning, because I've settled myself in. People are weird. They are so weird. Every human being I've ever come into contact with, whether they are friends, family, clients, staff members, colleagues, everyone is weird in their own unique ways. And I think it is absolutely beautiful. Sometimes a little annoying if you're not on the same wavelength as them, but that's why we get to choose our friends and not our family. It's a beautiful world. I think if people sit back and actually look at how different everyone is, I think it's just so much more beautiful than being all the same. No one wants to be all the same. And I think that's made very clear when we're kids is it's hard for autistic kids because they want to copy everyone because they don't want to be out of the ordinary. But then deep down, they want to be different and they know they're different. They just don't know how to explain it. But they're kind of around all bunch of kids that are neurotypical that know exactly how to explain how they're different. And that's hard. And I think it's really hard for parents too at the moment with all of this stuff that's going on with, they call it the rise in diagnosis. And we're not seeing a rise in diagnosis because people are just handing them out like lollipops, you know, they're learning more. They're seeing more about why women have gone undiagnosed for so long. And I think parents really struggle with that whole thing of, I don't want to label my kid because then they'll be more disabled. No, they won't. They will actually grow up in a space where they can understand why they think differently to their peers and why their brain works the way that they do. And I wish I was diagnosed earlier. I do. I wonder how many things I missed out on understanding about myself because I wasn't diagnosed earlier. I wonder how many times I was taken advantage of because I wasn't diagnosed earlier. But then you kind of got to look at the other side of the coin and go, how many things would I have maybe missed out on because of the diagnosis too? Would I have pushed myself to go to the Denny U muster? Probably not. I probably would have been like, no, that's not my thing. And then I went. It was definitely not my thing, but it was a lot of fun. I'll never probably have that opportunity again. I wouldn't have gone if I'd understood who I really was. I wouldn't have pushed myself to be normal either.
When I think about when I was younger, some of the stigma, I don't think I would have signed up for some of that. I know there is still a stigma, but it was very unknown at the time. It's an interesting timestamp that we're in at the moment with being able to explore this and having information about it.
Absolutely.
One of the things you wrote here was about the reality of working in the NDIS bed while being on the NDIS. What comes up for you when I say that?
I wrote a blog not long ago about how terrifying it is to be on the NDIS. You know, I've worked as a support coordinator, and so people think, oh, Erin could manage your own plan. I don't manage my own plan. I have a support coordinator and I have a plan manager because I don't ever want NDIS to come back at me and say, well, you should know how to do this. You've had a job doing this. And then I've screwed it up somehow. There's a level of accountability in there that I'm not willing to carry when it comes to a system that is consistently changing. I'm learning one thing and being told another thing. I totally understand why people want to self-manage, and I understand why people may not want support coordinators. But for someone who's been in that industry for a long time, I've seen people come up against different decisions that the NDIS has made. It causes a lot of stress. So my decision to do that was to reduce my stress. However, recently I applied to get some blockout curtains for this room, actually, because bright lights really bother me when I'm in meltdown. And I was rejected from that claim. And it really hurts me because I'm in this field and I know how many people have sensory issues, including myself, and we're not getting the support we need. And then I have to sit there and share with people, these are the ways that we have to go around getting the support we need. And it frustrates me so much to the point where I emailed my support coordinator and I say, you've got to do this. I actually do this today. I've done this for 10 other people today. I cannot even do it for myself. And I think it is a really scary thing to be on when they come out with all these changes and they've announced the Thriving Kids and with no further information, like they've just kind of put it out there and gone, here, chew on this. They're putting things under funding periods without really giving any kind of explanation of how that will affect everybody going forward or how to even request that to be changed if it's a significant risky situation where 6 hours might not be enough in the first 3 months to manage difficult situations. It's disappointing because I also see people who may not get great plans. And I think to myself, why did I get this great plan that I'm on? I'm on a really good plan. And it was because I could advocate for myself. In that situation, I know the background, I know the systems, I know what words to use because I work in the field and it gives me privilege that other people don't have. I try to use that as much as I can. I'll often do a little bit of pro bono work with trying to assist people with getting onto the NDIS if they've got the need for it. But it just shows me how much privilege I have on my NDIS plan because I understand things the way that I do. Sometimes I kind of wonder if everyone had that, we'd all have way better plans. And we may not have the same systemic issues that we have today if everybody had the ability to advocate for themselves like I do when it comes to my own services.
What would you suggest to people who do need to advocate or realize they need to advocate but don't know how to do that or they've got something to overcome with fear of being rejected or something along those lines?
I mean, we've got disability advocates out there and they're fantastic. Worked with the disability advocate in Ararat for a really long time and she was a force to be reckoned with, I'll say, absolute force, and it was fantastic. But the wait lists are extreme. They're 6 months plus to get in with an advocate at the moment, and that is something that's putting pressure on that system, and then we get them coming back to other systems and things like that. And I think putting pressure on your NDIS supports and saying to them, please teach me about NDIS. Support coordinators are supposed to teach people about how to manage their own NDIS plans, yeah? But they never get enough hours to do that. And there's never enough time to do that. So I would really start, if you've got a support coordinator, start pushing them that you want to learn how to do this. I wouldn't ever necessarily say that I want to do it, but teach me how to do it so that I can ask the pointy questions. But also, you know, AI is a fabulous tool. You can pretty much ask ChatGPT anything. And if you put in your issue about NDIS and ask it to give you the legislation where it actually states what the NDIS has said that they'll do, it will generally give you an answer. And then you can ask it to write an email for you, responding to the email they've sent you. I use AI every single day. So if you can't get into these services that can support you, try and utilize that AI, because it just takes that anxiety away from you having to write the right thing as well. So I'm all for ChatGPT. I saw this really interesting thing about ChatGPT recently, and it was like, ChatGPT is destroying the minds of our young people. And I thought, I bet you they haven't asked any neurodiverse people that, because I can get through my day. I don't sit there reading my email for 3 hours thinking, is this going to offend someone anymore? So I've done, instead of one email in 3 hours, I've done 10. So it's really quite groundbreaking for people that get stuck in the typical world.
Or even if there's something that's really overwhelming, I'm like, but in the past I would have spent ages just reading and rereading, like, what do I need to know? And now it's like, what do I need to know?
No, I respond to this email in a legislative or legal way that's right, you know? Please make it respectful so I don't sound like an asshole. So I'm like, this is how I feel right now. But I don't want to come across that way, because I know that I'm just maybe passionate or angry about this particular issue because somebody's been taken advantage of. So, you know, it can help me to sound less angry as well and a little bit more professional. There's so many ways it can be used. And honestly, if you can get a class that teaches you how to use AI as a self-advocacy tool or anything like that, I would do it, because I think it could be really groundbreaking. But I will encourage people not to use it for therapy. It's very validating on what you want for your life. But if you've got unhealthy coping mechanisms, it will also validate those which aren't great. So just use it for kind of facts and stuff, not necessarily therapy.
I like the disclaimer.
Yeah. I've seen lots of people using it for therapy. So I've done it. I've asked ChatGPT what's wrong with me today. And it wasn't very helpful. It kind of just pretty much told me what I wanted to hear. So, you know.
So the healthy eating and safe foods. Yeah. I'm so curious in terms of the stimuli. So that could be lights, foods. Really curious about that. Stimuli, healthy eating and safe food as a neurodivergent person.
I do want to kind of talk about my safe food stuff. So I had bariatric surgery about 2 years ago, and this was before my diagnosis anyway. I'd always had problems with my weight. I was always called the fussy, picky eater. I never understood why I couldn't eat yogurt or cottage cheese. I don't know what it is, but healthy eating plans are always shoving yogurt and cottage cheese at you like it's the only thing you can eat, right? And so it's true. It's like, here's some tuna out of a can with some cottage cheese and a biscuit, and have some celery with peanut butter, and have some yogurt at the end of the day. That's pretty much what they say to lose weight. And I hate every single one of those foods in those presentations, okay? I could eat those foods. So I like tinned tuna, but I like it with corn and mayo. I like yogurt, but frozen. I'll eat celery in a salad, but not in a stick. And I like peanut butter and cheese sandwiches, but not on celery. So when I said that to somebody, it's like, oh, I like those foods, because they'd ask me for a list of foods that I'd like. They'd make those options and I'd go, oh, I don't like those. And they'd go, but you told me you liked those foods. And I'm like, oh, yeah, I do like those foods. Okay, I'll give it a go. So I would try and I would try and try and try and try and try again. And so I was stuck in this perpetual motion of, I like these foods, but I don't understand why I don't like them. Then I had bariatric surgery. And even when you have bariatric surgery, it's all about yogurt. And it's all about cottage cheese, and it's all about pureed foods, and it's all about not drinking while you're eating, and it's all about, you know, small meals and blah, 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 blah. And I thought to myself, okay, maybe this is just the way I have to be. Maybe I have to change my brain and change my mindset, because that's what the world says. They're always out there like, change your mindset and you'll go far, and, you know, blah, 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 those stupid, you know, motivational videos that they make. The just do it. Just do it. Just buck up and drink a cup of concrete and just do it. If you want to get healthy, you have to be miserable. So when I got diagnosed, it didn't even occur to me that this was happening. And it's only occurred to me in probably the last 12 months that my eating is highly sensory. It is highly, highly sensory. I have my safe foods. I have my safe sometimes foods. I have foods that I'm willing to try. And then I also have foods that are great if I'm okay and I'm not overwhelmed. My husband is from Southeast Asia and he was a chef. So he really enjoys cooking lots of foods with flavor. It took a really long time to get him to kind of understand, but also because I didn't know what was going on, that if I've had a hard day at work, I don't want to come home and eat curry and bite down on a cardamom seed, because that to me is the most horrific thing in the world. Love cardamom. Cannot handle biting down on one of those seeds. It drives me crazy. So there was a lot of communication that had to happen around these are my safe foods. And then it was making sure they were stocked in the house and all of that. I've noticed that with my healthy eating, I've kind of slipped back into those old patterns. Like I love Zappo lollies and I love all types of lollies, sour lollies, crunchy lollies, fizzy lollies. The job that I'm working now, it can be really highly stressful. And I'm in a situation where I'm like, I don't know how to manage stress and healthy eating at the same time. So I'm just going to go and eat 2-minute noodles, chips and gravy. These are all my safe foods. They're not necessarily good for you. There's a lot of saturated fat. There's a lot of sugar, all those kinds of things. One day I just woke up and I was like, why haven't I figured out how to healthy eat with safe foods? Why haven't I done that yet? That seems so obvious to me. And then I was like, I have all these clients I know that are neurodivergent. And I work with a team of people that are basically all neurodivergent. Why haven't we figured out, why haven't I spoken to them about how do we make this happen? Healthy food that people can be feeling safe eating and don't feel like they're having to shove cottage cheese down their throat on a bad day and wanting to gag. There's literally nothing else. There's nothing out there. Not one thing I found has been about healthy eating with safe foods. And there are different levels of safe food too. Like you've got people that are really restricted and can only eat things like chicken nuggets and dry foods. And then you've got the other end of the spectrum, which is probably more so where I sit, which is I have a bunch of different categories of food for different ways that I feel. I want to put together a book and I want to write this book with other people consulting on it, dietitians, OTs, from that neurodivergent perspective, to put together a resource, but also a learning guide and training for people to say, this is how we can support people to eat healthy, lose weight, maybe even like manage their diabetes and those things. Because people that are neurodivergent, surprise, they sometimes do have diabetes as well. It doesn't take away all that other stuff. And how can we do that by supporting them and through their neurodivergence?
And higher levels of eating disorders as well, but probably because of the cycle that you just said, where there's an awareness of healthy or unhealthy, but then there's also an awareness of capacity and ability.
And, you know, starting to core foods, the media really pushes like, oh, you're eating unhealthy foods. Like, no, it's just less nutritious. And that's the angle I kind of want to take with it is like, okay, nuggets are less nutritious than the chicken breast, right? Just spitballing here. I'm not a dietitian, so I can't really say if they are or they aren't. But what if I added some other nutritious food to that chicken nugget, or I got someone like a support worker to come over and make me chicken nuggets, but add vegetables into them, would I still eat them? And exploring different ways of that. And it's all about the presentation. If we can present food, if we can present stimuli, if we can present different things in the world to people with neurodivergence that may need it presented in a different way, are we going to have better results? Probably. Yes, I can probably guarantee that we'll have better results. I went to a concert a few weeks ago. A friend of mine had given us free tickets to one of the corporate boxes. And it was the best way I've ever experienced a concert in my life. I've avoided concerts primarily because they're loud, but also because there's people rubbing up against each other. And that is just not my scene. But the concert was presented in a different way, an expensive way, unfortunately, which is probably not something most people can afford or I will ever be able to afford again. I just think let's start presenting the world in a different way. You might be surprised how many people actually start going to concerts. More ticket sales.
Yeah, I so agree with you. I sort of clicked onto the same thing with some of my clients, I was like, wow, I had never even conceptualized. And they would start asking loads of questions about textures. And it was, I'm just sharing this in case it's support true what you're doing. It wasn't always that the person didn't want to eat the food, but preparing the food. So the texture of, say, like cutting chicken up, it's not that they don't like eating chicken. And that was really interesting as well for us to start unpacking and going, what part of this food journey is the textural aspects or stimuli becoming too overwhelming to progress? Whereas we're just thinking, oh, I can't eat. Like, for some reason, I'm not eating as a blanket thing. Instead of making it, it's actually like a lot of things along the way that are happening. It was even when I really loved how you broke down into how you're feeling at different times or places or spaces, but even that sweet or salty. Because when you say safe foods, is that like the food where you're like, okay, I feel more myself?
Yeah, it's not necessarily nourishing. It's just getting something into my body because I know I have to eat. So if I don't eat, I get hypos.
Like regulating.
My blood sugar goes really low and then I end up shaking and sweating. So I have to eat. That's just something that I have to do. So for me, having a safe food, if I come home overwhelmed, if there's too many flavors in a food, I can't eat it. It actually makes me physically sick. But if I've had a really good day, I can eat that same food and be totally fine. It's just the level of what I have to process the information that I'm receiving. I think that's what we need to understand is like lights, information receiving, food textures, flavors, information receiving. If my cup is already up here and I can only take in that much, I'm not going to be able to information take all of the things that are coming into me, whether that's flavors or tastes, textures, light, sounds, people trying to have a conversation with me about finances at 9 p.m. at night. It's just not going to happen. My husband likes to do that. God bless him. He's an accountant, so he gets it. But I think if we kind of see everything in the world as intaking information, then it's a little bit easier to understand if we kind of put it into that perspective. Like everything we take in, everything we see, everything we hear is all information. And there's only so much one person can handle before they just explode. So safe foods to me, my safe foods, for example, I like Maggi chicken noodles in a cup, but I will not eat the beef and I will not eat the Oriental. And they have to be in a cup because I like the water in there. It gives me a bit of soup afterwards. It's very specific. If the brand changes, it's wrong. Like if you give me the fantastic ones or whatever they're called, they also have peas in them. No, I don't like the peas. They're too hard. They never cook right. So it has to just be the seasoning and the carrot, which are in the Maggi noodles. Another one is chips and gravy, but it has to be thick beef gravy. You can't just have air fried chips. Yeah, it has to be from the fish and chip shop. Very specific. And so that's what I think annoys people is like, why are you so rigid on this? And it's like, because I know if I don't have this particular one, I'm not going to eat tonight. And then the consequences of that.
Yeah. And it's also not like you described really well with the difference of if you're already overstimulated from the day, these are the outcomes. But to someone looking from outside in, they're like, well, yesterday you could eat that. So why can't you eat it today? And it's like, and it's almost like your whole body is like, nuh-uh, no.
Yeah, pretty much. And, you know, like I'll try. You know, my husband will make a really beautiful curry. And he'll serve it up for me and I'll eat three bites and then I'll find a bone that I wasn't expecting. And that's me done. I can't eat anymore because I'm like, oh, I don't like bone and meat. But if there happens to be like a rogue bone on a good day, I'm like, yeah, cool, just put it on the side. But the minute I kind of bite into anything or can see a bone if I'm overwhelmed, I can't eat it. I physically cannot eat it and I physically feel sick. And then I'm like, well, that's me and cereal for the night, you know. And it's taken a while for him to understand that too, because, you know, in his culture, it's like if you don't eat the food that they make you, there's a level of offense there. So it's taken him a while to kind of wrap his head around, she's not offending me. She'll probably want to eat it tomorrow anyway. It's a journey and it's an understanding journey. And I really, you know, I do feel for people that are neurodivergent within that safe food, having to explain it constantly to people. But I also do feel for neurotypical people that are caring for people with those food aversions, because it's basically a guessing game of what can they tolerate today. Unless the person is able to communicate that appropriately, it can be just a guessing game. And it can be really frustrating to cook food you know, say it's 35 degrees, you're cooking food, and then someone says, I don't want that. It's like, I've just gone to all of this effort to make your safe food, and now you don't want it. It can be frustrating and quite difficult for people to hear. So I think having a resource and being able to say, okay, well, let's have all these kind of standbys as well. I really like those little the snacks with the cheese and bickies, you know. I like having a cereal in the cupboard just in case I can't eat something, or a couple of my noodle packets, just so that if I can't eat it today, I'll try again tomorrow. And I think, you know, kind of getting it into people's heads that we're not trying to offend you by any means. It's literally just my body physically reacts to it. It's not just a brain thing. Body actually physically wants to vomit if I take too much in. So, yeah, I think it'll be a really exciting project to do. I'm really hoping that I get other people to kind of join me because, you know, there are things that I want to put into this resource that I don't have expertise on.
I would love to be a part of sharing some of the resources because we've developed alongside other people who are working with this, just out of curiosity and noticing.
Yeah.
I've got a little sheet as well for parents to give the teachers at a daycare or a school if the young person is choosing not to eat. Like, when do they eat? What happened before? Like, trying to work out the stimuli around. Is it where they're studying? And I know that can be frustrating, but at the same time, I feel in the long run of things, it's actually going to be really valuable for everyone to understand that because everyone will have the outcomes they want and everyone is working towards the same outcomes. It's just that sometimes our ways of getting there can differ because of our different ways that our brains work. So
I think once you understand that, you can almost take the value out of it. So, okay, I'm cooking this food because I want to be really kind to somebody and then they go, no, I don't want that. I guess taking the value out of that person saying, I don't want that, because it doesn't mean anything to the person that's neurodivergent. It just means I can't have this right now, or I don't like the way this is presented, or this is too much information for me. It's not a way of showing their values or how much they value or how much they don't value. It's literally just communication. I'd love to be able to communicate better, but sometimes I can't. And I think ending that level.
I think it's like similar to what you were saying at the beginning. I think it's cool to learn. Like, I find that the more that I learn about myself and unmask and like find out, okay, actually, I don't like that, or I don't want that, or I've never wanted that. I can actually communicate it. But before I become aware that I was just going along with that because I thought I had to, then you can't communicate it.
No, because you don't even know what it is. I don't know why I don't like cottage cheese. I can look at it and go, okay, it looks like curds or mushy and stuff, but what exactly don't I like about it? Is it the taste? Is it the texture? Is it the flavor? Now I can go, actually, I don't like the texture and I don't like the way it looks and it's presented to me. But if somebody mixed said cottage cheese into like a cake or something, I'd be like, I wouldn't know.
For me, I like some brands and not others. It's like, can be a brand thing. It's like there's a slight difference in taste of some cottage cheeses.
Yeah. I love it when people go to Aldi and they're like, oh, you know, it's exactly the same as the one in Woolies. It was made in the same factory. I'm like, yeah, okay. It may be made in the same factory, but it tastes completely different because the paper that it's wrapped in is made out of something different. Like when you have a Coke, like a Coca-Cola, if you have it in a bottle versus a can, it actually tastes different. Yeah. And it's the same thing with anything that food's wrapped in. If you wrap it in metal versus plastic, it's going to taste different. And yeah, it's my favorite thing when people say it's, oh, you know, it's exactly the same thing. It was $5 cheaper. And I'm like, yeah, no, I'm going to spend the extra $5, have my autism ADHD tax to buy the same bottle because it tastes completely different.
I was going to say that was with both those things because my partner has it as well. And there'll be some things he's like, no, don't want that. And I had to just decide on myself, if I'm in a cook day, I want to cook. That's nothing to do with him at all, but I'm in a cook day because I'm not always in a cook day, you know.
No, and that's the other thing too. It's so rare for me to be in like, I want a cook day, and I'll have something on the menu. Like, we'll have meal plan. And oh my God, the meal planning, right? They all go, healthy eating is all about meal planning. And I'm like, yeah, okay, cool. So when I get to Tuesday, I'm definitely going to want that food. No, I want something different. The weather's different. It's hot. So I want a salad or I want this. It's so difficult to maintain any of those neurotypical standards of healthy eating when your whole world is changed by 2 degrees, or you had a really good day at work, so you feel really motivated, or you did some exercise this morning and you feel like you want to change your whole lifestyle, but it'll only last a day because that's kind of how long motivation lasts. It just changes so quickly. I think tonight our menu is like pasta, but I'm probably going to go out there and say to my husband, I'll be like, look, I'm going to cook prawn salad tonight because it's hot and I don't want to eat something hot. And he'll just go, oh my God, she's changed it again. And that's just because he loves routine as well. But he's kind of getting better at just going with it now and saying, hey, she wants to cook. I don't have to. This is fantastic. I'll just cook that tomorrow night. And so I totally agree with the whole cooking thing.
The other thing I was going to say, which sucks, I think, but it's what I've decided, but not everyone has this capacity, but was when you were talking about the ADHD tax. It's like, I've just accepted that that's a thing in my life. I'm like, okay, if I want to eat the foods that are going to be healthier, safe foods or whatever, I need to pay that tax. Like, that's actually what needs to happen in my life.
Yeah, and it is true. It's that there is this tax that we kind of have to pay. Like, for example, I will constantly lose things, so I then have to buy them again. I loved it when I think it was Loops, they came out with a deal where if you lost your pair, you could buy another pair for half price. But I was like, but I've still lost them. You know, it sucks. I constantly lose things. Like, I have AirTags on everything. My keys, my wallet, my bag, my phone. My husband even puts one on me when we go out into busy areas because I just wander off into the ether. Then there's the uneaten fruit that I've bought on a whim because I'm like, I'm going to eat more fruit that's sitting there in the bowl, almost rotten. And I'm like, I'm going to make banana bread out of those bananas. It's never going to happen. So here's $100 worth of fruit, essentially a month that goes in the bin or goes into the compost because that's my tax that I have to pay for being uninterested. So I just try and shop every day, which then also becomes tiring because after work, I don't want to go to the supermarket. The constant choices of what are we going to eat today? It can be a lot. Just thinking about food on an everyday basis is just crazy. I never knew how much energy it was to actually just think about what I'm going to eat 3 times a day. One of the other things I want to put in the book is around the task analysis of those kinds of things. So how many steps does it take? For me to have a shower, it takes up to 14 steps between getting into the room, turning on the light, taking off my clothes, getting a towel, turning on the water, making sure it's adjusted, turning on the fan, getting in the shower, then all the things you have to do in the shower. It's above 20 steps for me. For somebody else, it might be 5. It's like, get in the shower, turn on the tap, get out, dry yourself, done. So it's different for everybody. And it doesn't matter whether you're neurotypical or neurodivergent. Everything has steps and you think about it differently for everyone. So a lot of the neurodivergent people that I've met really struggle with breaking things down into steps. And if a meal takes more than... I love how Jamie Oliver has his like 20-minute cookbooks. That's still like 50 steps. So I like having recipes that are broken down into steps. Like, okay, you only need 5 steps, 10 steps, 15 steps, 20 steps. It doesn't matter what those steps are. As long as they're broken down, it'll happen if you can manage that amount. So, yeah, I think that'll be really cool. I'm excited about it.
I was explaining to my mum because I've ordered this. It's an ADHD robot. And
yeah. What?
I don't know if it's actually a scam, but I'm like excited about it. But then sent like a little tester thing. You tell it about your calendar and you just type in, I need this, and it just puts in the calendar. And I was thinking afterwards, I was like, I love this, because before it required looking at the calendar, working out where it wants to go, opening the calendar event thing, checking that the date's right, putting the correct label, putting the correct color so that I know what it's for. And that's what, like 6-7 steps just to put in the event in. Whereas this thing,
I
you
need
go,
this robot.
Yeah, I'm gonna send it to you.
I was like,
my mum, she could not get it at all. But I was like, it's so good because, and then even if it does something wrong, I just go, oh, that's wrong. Can you move it to here? It's like 1 step.
Oh my God, that sounds so good. I saw this lady who had all these like little, I guess they were like the AirTags, but they were like magnets, and she'd stick them all over her house. And they were set up so that if she touched her phone to it, it would automatically send a message. So if she had one on the dog food, it would send a message to her partner saying, I've already fed the dogs. Don't feed them again. They're greedy. And I was like, oh my God, I could have that. Like, you know, yes, I locked the door because I'm terrible with locking doors. And oh, yes, I've turned my hair straightener off. I need these in my life because there's so many things that would make life easier. And they are coming out with all of these awesome things. We just need to find them and share them a lot.
Yeah, I think that's why I love this discussion so much. It is genuinely things that make, did you call it a sort of analysis paralysis or decision making or cognitive overload? It makes it less. Yeah. So then I can actually do things with my day. It's like becoming stuck on what should I do? That's important and that's important and that's important and that's important. And whereas like if there's these little things where the little things are being taken care of, they just go away.
That task analysis, it's amazing what happens when you actually sit down and look at it. I remember I was in my class, my grad cert, and they put us into breakout rooms. The lecturer was like, okay, I want you to break this down into tasks individually and then come together and share how many you got. And it was making the bed. And there was no further information. There was no, are you making the bed because you just got out of it? Or are you making the bed because there's no sheets on it? Like, let's be specific, people. And I think I had over 24 steps and the others had a range between 7 and 10. And they were like, how did you get 24 steps? And I'm like, well, you know, you've got to do each corner. And they're like, isn't that just one step? And I'm like, no, no, it's not. So my brain interprets all those steps. And so I have 24 things I need to do on my to-do list and you have 7. Awesome. Mine's going to take a lot longer than yours, but not necessarily. But it feels that way. It's all about perception and information and actually quite an easy bunch of people to understand, really. Once you understand us.
I was going to say the other thing I found really helpful is FocusMate. It's this thing where you log in. And it's sort of like a Zoom call type thing, but you just tell the person, okay, I use it a lot for my dishes. So I'm going to do my dishes now and it'll be for half an hour, sort of like focus. And then you say, I've done my dishes, or you might be like, sorry, I got distracted. I haven't done my dishes. Whatever happens. It's been interesting for two factors. One is because I didn't actually know how long it took me to do my dishes because I would get so distracted all the time. It would take me ages. Because I would sort of do it and then I was like, oh, that needs to go there or that needs to move. And there would be all these other little tasks in between. But also just being realistic. So it genuinely takes me about half an hour to do dishes. That's the actual length of time.
This morning, that's so funny because like I'm hearing you say this, I'm like, you are me. So like I ran the water this morning to clean the dishes. I put on one glove. Then I was like, oh, I should probably get dressed because I've got to be somewhere at that time. So I turn off the tap, I go into the bedroom, I get dressed, I come back out and like, where's my glove? Can't do the dishes without a glove because I can't handle the water being so hot. So I spend 10 minutes looking for this glove that I've lost. And then I come out and finally do the dishes. And I'm like, well, at least I'm dressed, haven't brushed my teeth, haven't done my hair, but I found the glove.
It's so true. And sometimes I'm like talking to myself going, is this object important? Do I actually need this object to progress with my day?
Yes. Yes, I do. It's definitely 100% needed. I need my glove. I can't do it with one glove. It'll feel so weird with one glove in the water. I actually did have this kind of inner fight with myself. Could I do the dishes with one hand instead of going to find the glove? I was like, no, but don't be stupid, Erin. That's just silly. You need bright gloves. If my head wasn't attached to my body, I would lose it. And it's funny because that's who I've always been. I thought I was just useless and stupid and weird, but now I'm like, oh, yeah, that's because my executive functioning is thinking about 10 other things at the same time, so I'm actually a genius. Yay. When you sit back and actually look at your day and you're like, how did I end up here? One of the best ways I've learned to fall asleep is to recount what you did throughout the day because your brain doesn't stop working constantly. I came into this room and I sat down at this desk. And then before that, I had a drink. Eventually, you fall asleep. I sometimes think to myself, I did so many things today. How am I still awake? It's quite incredible how many times I get distracted throughout the day. And work, I get distracted all the time. Yesterday, I was fixing somebody's account and then 2 minutes later, I was like, oh, yeah, I better send that email. So I started the draft of the email, and then one of my staff members came in. And so after about 20 minutes, my director came back to me and was like, hey, did you do that thing on the person's account to fix it? And I was like, yeah, I was halfway through it. And then I had to send an email. And that's the thing about working in that environment. She's like, okay. Like, she knows I'll get back to that. It's not like, you need to send it and you need to send it now, like this very minute. It's not a life and death situation. And that's the understanding that truly supports people in the workplace, going back to that. But also, I kind of just laugh at it because I'm like, how did I end up with so many distractions? Okay, refocus. Let's try and figure it out. And that's the other thing I've learned, is sometimes just to laugh at myself, because if I don't, I'll cry. But it's also kind of hilarious that, you know, I've ended up starting 3 tasks and finishing them at the end of the day with a bunch of other tasks in between. Hey, I still got it done, didn't I? So I'm proud of myself for that, which is great. You know, leaning into the chaos. Yep. It's been the best thing about it, leaning into that and being able to help people do that too, and giving people permission to cry and giving people permission to need to do the work. One of the staff that we had the other day was really struggling with the whole process of figuring out an NDIS plan funding. I said, well, you do the background finance stuff that I don't know how to do, and you just tell me what you've done and I'll communicate it to the external person, because then that took the weight of him having to professionalize his response. To me, he just wrote it on a post-it and said, here it is. And then I put it into a way that could be understood in a more professional way. And I think it's all about leaning into it for your staff. We've got a neurotypical person in our office. I don't think we'd probably run as efficiently if we were all neurodivergent. We need some kind of routine and maintenance in there, yeah? But even she's taken on little traits. I think it's because there's that freedom to be you. I think even neurotypical people strive in that. You know, if we took all the KPIs and all of that stuff out of the world, and the expectations and you should and you shouldn't, I don't really think it's that hard to create a world that's safe. It's just they're worried that something bad will happen maybe, or, you know, things would change. People really don't do change very well, whether you're neurodivergent or neurotypical. So, yeah. I think we just change it one bit at a time.
Thank you so much for your time today.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
Everyone, to a close, is there anything you would want to share at all that's still left?
Just kind of something from my personal journey, which is that it's okay to not know, and it's okay to just go with it. And if you're not really sure about it, you can always ask a friend that might be neurodivergent. You can always jump onto the advice lines or Facebook. They have all those groups and things like that. But don't ever be ashamed of that part of yourself, because I can guarantee someone else is going through it as well. And you're not alone. You're really not. There's been so many people that have asked me if I've been through different things. And I'm like, oh yeah, that's a daily. That is honestly daily for me. And they're like, oh, really? And I'm like, yeah, of course it is. I think about that all the time. It's my Roman Empire, so to speak, as they say. Multiple things in my Roman Empire. So if you have multiple Roman Empires, you're not alone there either. So yeah, reach out. Reach out is a really big thing. And probably my last thing to say about neurodivergent people in the workplace is, don't try and get people to fit into the mold that is for everybody else. Ask that person what they need to thrive in the workplace. They may not know at the time, and you may be able to offer some things, but just be aware that what research says about people that are neurodivergent and things that work may not work for that person. You might need to try again.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Thanks so much. It was fun.